Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Natalie Dowzicki.
And I'm Landry Ayers.
On this day, the 4th of November, the day after the 2020 presidential election, the only verdict is vengeance, a vendetta, held as a votive not in vain, for the value and veracity of such shall one day vindicate the vigilant and the virtuous. And we all must remember the 5th of November. Joining us today to talk about another Wachowski dystopia, V for Vendetta, are two of Cato's very own, research fellow Patrick Eddington.
Hello there.
And senior fellow Julian Sanchez.
Hey.
Julian, Pat, the iconic Guy Fawkes mask worn by V in this film, I think arguably has had a more enduring legacy than the movie itself. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, we can get to. Do you think audiences are missing the point by lionizing V?
So, you know, it was always, I think, even in Alan Moore's original graphic novel, a sort of strange choice to make Guy Fawkes the sort of emblem of... I mean, Guy Fawkes was not some kind of anarchist, authoritarian revolutionary. He was a radical Catholic who plotted to blow up a democratic institution, or at least as democratic as you got in that era, you know, essentially because he was a theocrat and didn't like the idea of abandoning a Catholic Britain. So sort of an unlikely anarchist hero. But it is also worth noting that in a sense, I think the meaning that the Guy Fawkes mask has taken on in the sort of modern context, where it's been adopted by groups like Anonymous, really has its origins in something that is original to the film. That is the scene sort of near the end where V has sort of mailed out these Fawkes masks to, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people in Britain. And they all kind of march out with the masks on to support this anti-authoritarian revolution that V has sparked. And that just none of that happens in the comic book. In the comic, there's a scene where, people come out sort of angry and confused, not necessarily, in support of V, and are addressed by Evie, who's sort of taken up the mantle of V. But so this sort of everyone coming out doing an I Am Spartacus and adopting the V mask as sort of a symbol of a kind of mass movement is just a total creation of the film. But I think that's the scene that folks like Anonymous have in mind when they adopt that. And I should say it is something we've actually seen in a bunch of sort of early noughts and late 90s superhero movies. I said before, I think when we talked about Watchmen, that there is a kind of whiff of inherent fascism to superheroes. Right. I mean, Superman is essentially an English translation of Übermensch. So you see in, for example, Spider-Man 2, a kind of
amazing, one of my favorites.
But you see this sort of attempt at a kind of populist moment where the very special hero has these powers, but needs kind of the population. Really, in both Spider-Man movies, in the first Spider-Man movie, there's the crowd scene where people start pelting the Green Goblin with bottles and rocks and things because you can't mess with New York. And in the second one, he sort of passes out on the train after saving it, and everyone just sort of gives him his mask back and helps him and agrees not to sort of reveal his identity. You saw it in, I think, Superman Returns. There's a kind of similar scene where Superman kind of needs to be saved by masses of ordinary people. And so there's something of that in, I think, that final scene here that, again, I think is why the Fawkes mask has become this sort of mass icon. And it's part of this attempt to inject something more populist in the original graphic novel. I think it remains much more of a kind of individualist anarchist. And, you know, I mean, Moore is certainly a man of the left, but there is a more sort of Stirnerian individualist flavor to his anarchism. At least, you know, the anarchism of V for Vendetta, anyway, of which is kind of borderline more juvenilia.
So I think that, you know, the whole episode with the gunpowder plot, and the reason that, you know, the mask itself, you know, becomes a thing with Occupy Wall Street and as Julian indicated, Anonymous and all the rest of that, really goes back, at least in my view, to this idea of governmental oppression against a particular group or element that is disfavored, right? And so I think, you know, to kind of put it in the modern context, you know, the Occupy movement, to the extent that it had any coherence at all, was essentially a reaction against what the demonstrators perceived to be, you know, an out of control, unaccountable, you know, capitalist run system that was, you know, allegedly responsible for all the evils afflicting society and so on and so forth. And I think, you know, any time that you have a movement that feels like it's dealing with an asymmetric power dynamic, and that's really what we are talking about here, you know, it's going to have that kind of effect. But there's no question, Landry, that I think that you're absolutely right, that which is unfortunate, because, you know, I've never really been a huge comic book guy, so I'll make that admission right now. So I haven't read the original V for Vendetta here, but I think the number of parallels that this movie has for where we are in 2020 is pretty alarming. It is pretty scary. I mean, and that I don't think that you can, you know, 100%, you know, necessarily analogize to it, but, you know, this whole idea that the coronavirus is a hoax, and then, you know, to the movie, you know, it's like, oh, these terrorists are responsible for this virus, and when in fact it was the government itself. And of course, the podcast on All the President's Men that we did a couple of weeks ago, we talked in that particular episode about this whole genre of movies essentially dealing with, you know, government skullduggery, conspiracies, all the rest of that. You know, this, for me, V for Vendetta is, you know, is one of the more contemporary examples of that.
This is one of many changes between the graphic novel and the film, is that in the graphic novel, Norse Fire, the sort of fascist regime in Britain, rises to power following some sort of limited nuclear war involving the United States. So this sort of, I guess, plandemic storyline where, you know, the characters discover over the course of the film that Norse Fire actually rose to power following this biological weapons attack that caused many hundreds of deaths, but was actually developed and released by elements within the government itself. That whole sort of plandemic storyline is also original to the film. I think, you know, probably just as an update, in part because maybe we have a very different sense of how survivable, you know, a limited nuclear exchange would be for the planet.
And what folks may not remember or realize is that there was actually a fairly virulent fascist element in the UK during the 1930s. You know, the British Union of Fascists. You know, so there is also, you know, kind of a hearkening back, you know, to that odious tradition, if you will. But I think that, you know, when I look at this film, and I really do want to talk about this, you know, just from kind of a critical cinematic standpoint, I have always been outraged, and I mean absolutely outraged, that Hugo Weaving did not win an Oscar for this. I mean, his performance was simply outstanding. And of course, you know, this is the guy that gave us such a memorable character from the Matrix movies, and did a pretty good job as Elrond in Lord of the Rings. But to be able to carry off that performance and to successfully communicate, you know, that level essentially of passion and emotion and all the rest of that through that entire getup, that entire garb, you know, a lot of stage actors, you know, wind up, you know, if you're a fan of the opera and all the rest of that, but you're not talking about, like, you know, complete covering there. So I've always felt that Weaving, you know, got shortchanged in just a massive way for his performance in that.
I mean, it's certainly a stumbling block or a difficulty for an actor to be able to perform through, you know, an unchanging mask and not being able to use, you know, in particular, Weaving's kind of incredibly expressive face. So, you know, having that hand tied behind his back, it's impressive, especially, you know, in some of those scenes, it's not actually Weaving's body. It's his voice dubbed over James Purefoy's acting. And you'd never know if you hadn't, you know, read the Wikipedia, I guess.
One thing that you all sort of mentioned that specifically the changes from the source material of Alan Moore's graphic novel, comic books, to the film is a sort of shift from the focus of the original, which is much more about like British Thatcherism based on, you know, when it was written and the reaction to that. And the movie, certainly, though it is set in England, and to me was a little refreshing at first to see a fascist movie that was not set in the United States, I realized pretty quickly that it was much more of a commentary on what seemed to be like post 9/11 America than what the source material would be about. You know, you have the sort of dumbing down of the racial purity themes. They even change Norse Fire's motto from strength through purity, purity through faith. It becomes strength through unity, unity through faith. So there's that sort of removal. And it heavily focuses on anti-Islamic sentiment and this sort of homo antagonism, some of which is still present in the source material, but it's much more highlighted. So what do you think it specifically says about that time period, whether it's, you know, what we see today with the sort of Trump administration, or specifically the, you know, George W. Bush subsequent administration that was going on when this movie was being produced? And how different would a film be if it was more devoted to the source material? Maybe, Julian, you could enlighten us to that since you're familiar with it.
Sure. I mean, yeah, there's certainly a lot of that. Louis Prothero, the kind of propagandist who's killed relatively early on in the in the comic, is actually sort of poses as the voice of fate, which is a sort of AI supercomputer that helps plan the fascist state for the government. And he's, you're essentially supposed to be the voice of the computer itself speaking to reassure the nation. Here, he is reimagined as much more of a kind of a Fox News style personality, essentially. You know, explicitly talking about the problem of godlessness and how the virus is a judgment on the U.S. for being insufficiently godly. There's a great bit of business, by the way. One of my favorite scenes that's really original to the film is him in the shower watching himself on these enormous screens he has in his bathroom.
Yeah.
And and kind of voicing along to his own sort of Jeremiad on the television. You know, certainly they've updated a lot of things from the, you know, not just the pandemic as opposed to the nuclear exchange as the kind of instigating force, but also, right, a lot more focus on both Islam and on sexual minorities, as opposed to the racial purity that was much more at the core of the concerns in the original graphic novel. And, you know, one angle I think it's important to stress here is the... You know, the fact that as sort of no one really knew, I guess, at the time the film came out, like The Matrix, this is a film made, I know it was directed by James McTeague, but it was executive produced and written by the Wachowskis. So I think it's fair to call this a Wachowski movie. But absolutely. So this is a movie that was essentially made by, again, much like The Matrix, by a pair of trans women who at the time were not openly trans. Maybe, I'm not sure to what extent they themselves thought of themselves as trans, but were just struggling with their own gender identities at the time. But of course, no one knew that. They were at the time known as the Wachowski brothers. And I know Lily Wachowski has said that really the Matrix should be seen as an allegory for transgenderism, right? You have a protagonist who discovers, in effect, in the first act of the movie, that his body is not his body. And that this makes him different from those around him and gives him, to some extent, sort of special abilities. And the film is essentially about embracing and discovering this kind of difference about himself. You see this in characters. Some of the stuff was sort of taken out, like the character of Switch in that film, who was supposed to be a different gender inside and outside the Matrix, sort of stressing the kind of the illusoriness or the artificiality of the body. And I think a lot of the differences between the source material and the film can be to some extent sort of illuminated by kind of retroactively viewing it in the light of this is again something produced by a couple of trans women who are at the time presenting as male and you know maybe only beginning to really come to terms with their own gender identities. There is, for example, the character of Gordon Dietrich is totally different. This is Stephen Fry's character who in the graphic novel, Evie is basically a 16-year-old, I suppose, aspiring prostitute who ends up having a, you know, effectively a sexual relationship with this guy Dietrich, who is certainly not gay in the graphic novel, before being sort of abducted again by V. So the centrality of Dietrich as a kind of closeted gay man who you know, talks quite explicitly about being unable to be open about his sexual identity or his you know, orientation, at least, is becomes a much more central character, becomes in a sense an aid to V, or someone who picks up the challenge from V by producing this satirical broadcast lampooning the fascist leader and pays for it. But that again recenters this on questions of sexual identity. There are lines that are original to the movie, as far as I can tell, that I think can be interestingly read as an extension of that theme about the artificiality of the body. There's a line where Evie reaches out to touch V's mask, and he sort of says, "No. There's a face behind this mask, but that isn't me any more than my muscles or the skeleton behind my face." You know, consonant with the kind of ideas are bulletproof. It doesn't matter who V is. V is sort of an idea. But also, again, I think read through that light can be seen as an extension of that idea of the self that matters is not in any real important sense the self of the body. And also, I think maybe throws a different light on that very significant changed ending, where instead of being kind of angry and confused and hearing Evie speak as the new V, the people themselves come out. And actually, as they take off their masks at the end, we see characters who have died, including Stephen Fry's Dietrich and Valerie, who we know died years earlier at Larkhill. But that final scene where, in a sense, the whole community becomes V, and then all feel comfortable unmasking. Strike me again in terms of thinking of this in terms of trans women struggling with their own identity, that it seems as odds with sort of bodily presentation, and then finding this kind of acceptance that doesn't really happen. It's left ambiguous in the graphic novel. It's just, I think that's an illuminating or an interesting angle on it that no one, when the film came out, really, you know, would have had the information necessary to see it through that lens.
I think around that same part that that Evie was like going for V's mask, she said something along the lines as, "You wear a mask for so long that you forget who you are beneath it," which I also thought was interesting because you're going along with that V as an idea, not necessarily like a person. And I thought that was just interesting how they were bringing up again the mask, like Landry said earlier, is one of the things that has really like had a prolonged presence much past the film. And another thing I think we should bring up from the original material is that I was reading up that Alan Moore was actually really irritated with how they adapted the graphic novel for film because he thought they kind of watered down the dialogue about fascism versus anarchy, which is really present in the original source material. But the script that the Wachowskis made is obviously centers on like political themes that were currently going on in American politics. So that's back in 2005. So they're critiquing the politics of that time, which then really changed the original story to no longer be about like fascism versus anarchy. Though obviously V is an anarchist, but I think it's interesting that there's that line where the Alan Moore is kind of upset that they went this road with the adaptation.
I mean, Alan Moore, I don't think Alan Moore has ever liked any adaptation of anything that's been done with his work. But.
One of the things that disappointed me at least a little bit was essentially just these fleeting references to Islamophobia, right? So, you know, when Evie is, you know, getting basically finishing her makeup and all the rest of that before she's going to head over to Diedrich's relatively early in the film, you know, Prothero is the voice of London is on there basically talking about the ulcered sphincter of Arsarica, referring to the United States. And she's, you know, watching him. And he makes, you know, just that one reference to, you know, what had to be done and getting rid of the so-called degenerates and homosexuals and Muslims. And then you only get the other reference, of course, when Evie, you know, manages to escape from the pedophile priest, pedophile bishop, I should say, and gets over to Diedrich's place. He takes her in, and then, you know, he literally brings her into his real world in that hidden anteroom where he's got a copy of a 14th century illuminated copy of the Quran. And I wish that there had been, you know, a little bit more of a treatment, you know, on what had happened essentially to, in this case, British Muslims. Because, of course, at the time this film came out, and I can't remember if it came out before the Stellar Wind revelations or after the Stellar Wind revelations, but it definitely came out after all of those initial raids, you know, in the early days after 9/11, where so many Arab and Muslim men were rounded up. Some of them were, in fact, Americans who were captured in these immigration raids. And the entire climate, essentially, that was created there for that particular community, and how it continues to this day, right? I mean, the Trump administration literally doubled down in many respects with respect to the Muslim ban, and the continued, you know, attacks essentially on Arab and Muslim Americans and all the rest of that. So I wish that they had that they'd gone into that, you know, in a little bit deeper detail there, but you know that's also essentially a deviation from Moore's, you know, original.
Well, it's also important, right, for the success of the movie that it's relevant to what was going on during that time period. But like you said, there's a lot of things that we can relate to today as well. And the movie came out, 15 years ago now, or 16 years ago now. And I think another big part that we haven't really hit on yet is that, like, we're kind of meant to hate the movie's imagery of like dictatorship and how violent they are and like how they're how they treat minorities, and like you were just saying, Pat, but by the end we're supposed to find like V's violence against the dictatorship good and like emotionally satisfying. And I think we talked about this during actually our discussion about the Purge movies, but it's this like idea that we want the hero to enact violence against the dictatorship, but we like abhor the violence the dictatorship is executing. So I think there's like, again, this weird tension that like we're celebrating violence, like we're celebrating blowing things up because V, in a sense, like has gotten his idea has spread, and that was the goal.
You know, let's just be brutally honest about our culture here. A celebration of violence is as American as apple pie. Ours is arguably the most violent culture on earth, I think, in so many ways, right? I mean, and I think what you're kind of alluding to here, Natalie, is, you know, the amount of violent content that you just see in our entertainment industry, and how much people eat that up. And I think about, you know, in the context of political repression and police repression specifically, you know, one of the reasons that the police in this country, you know, have managed to get a pass for so long, I think, is because of the cultural context. You know, it started with, you know, really, you know, benign movies or benign series like Dragnet, right? And I'm really dating myself when I talk about that one. One Adam 12, also dating myself. But, you know, then you fast forward, and it's not until you get to a series like Hill Street Blues that you begin to get, you know, a little bit more nuanced, you know, look at cops and policing and their relationship to the public and this whole issue of police violence. And then you finally get NYPD Blue, where I think you actually get something a lot closer to reality. But it's taken us a long time as a culture, and I think among the white Protestant majority in this country, it's taken a long time to really kind of begin to come to grips with a lot of that. And I think that, you know, we do celebrate violence, you know, against a tyrannical power. I mean, that's what our founding, you know, was allegedly about. That's also kind of a fairy tale too, you know, in a lot of respects. But we absolutely do. And I don't care if it's Star Wars or Star Trek or, you know, fill in the blank. There's just, we live in a society that is extremely comfortable with violence and often casual violence. And I think, the Purge movies are an awesome example of that. but it says something about us, right? And something I think that's not necessarily, you know, always super awesome in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, V is very much, you know, I think, again, this is a very early Moore work. And I think V is very much a kind of anarchist Mary Sue, you know, sort of superhero badass of the sort that I think is kind of interestingly deconstructed in Grant Morrison, the other, you know, sort of the next great, I suppose, along with Neil Gaiman, kind of British comics scribe. In his series, The Invisibles, you have King Mob, who's another, again, kind of anarchist, super badass. But that role and his relationship to sort of aestheticized cool violence is much more directly interrogated there. There's certainly things in the film that read a little differently now. His rationalization, for example, of the killing of Louis Prothero, who is effectively a media figure, and I don't know if I dignify him with the title journalist, but a kind of a media figure, an anchor. We learn eventually, of course, that he's killed in part for crimes committed as a kind of commandant at a camp where human experimentation is being done. But at the time, the film audience at least is not necessarily aware of this, and so it is sort of justifying the killing of a media person for, for spreading for fake news of a sort. So I think that reads a little more uncomfortably now. And it is, it is interesting. There are things that I think where the movie maybe fails a little bit because it is sort of uncomfortable in places with really depicting the kind of horror of what V is doing. So if you look at the scenes where I think partly I just think Natalie Portman is maybe miscast here in significant part just because her terrible British accent is distracting.
That's true.
But if you look at the scenes where he does this sort of horrifying thing, right? He kidnaps and tortures psychologically deconstructs this woman, leading her to believe that she's in prison and is going to be killed, physically, effectively tortures her. I guess this is supposed to be justified in the end because it brings her to this sort of transfiguring experience. And she ultimately endorses it and believes she's a better person. But, you know, people who are brainwashed often come out of it thinking, oh, I'm so glad I've been shown the light by your process of, you know, kind of mental conditioning. It's still this sort of appalling thing. And in a way, I don't think those scenes entirely work because one of the things I noticed as I was rewatching it for this is really they are afraid to make Natalie Portman look sort of as harrowed and beat up as someone would be realistically. I mean, she's still basically Natalie Portman. She looks very pretty. She looks like she's getting a cute haircut when her head is going. She's crying, but she still looks like a very attractive Natalie Portman with a little bit of kind of, you know, eye makeup to make her look tired. But they're not really willing to make her look like someone who has been sort of beaten and starved and subject to sleep deprivation. So she still looks pretty good in those final scenes where she's, supposedly been there for days or weeks. And I think in maybe one reason for that is just that it would be, I think, difficult to ever find V sympathetic again if you did not, to some extent, soften the reality of this sort of horrific thing he's doing to her, nominally for her own good. But he sounds like a kind of classic abuser when he's sort of explaining why he did this for her own benefit.
If he had done that to me, I can guarantee you that I wouldn't go Stockholm syndrome. I would want to go full Mandalorian on him. That's where I would be. I would not be grateful for that. I would not be thanking anybody for that. I agree with you, Julian. I think, Charlize Theron in the Mad Max remake would be a much more, towards the end of the movie, a much more realistic depiction of what happened there. But yeah, I think even with the flaws, we've discussed here, with the film and the fact that it's a wee bit dated now, I still think there is an enormously, powerful and potentially very useful and timely message about opposition to authority and quite frankly, how we can be literally just, one generation away from having, this American experiment slip away from us. I think that Reagan, was very, very on point when he made that observation. And it does concern me deeply, the path that we appear to be on now. I mean, I've a lot of people talking about the destruction of norms and all the rest of that. And clearly, this film depicts norms being bulldozed, blown up, incinerated, and so on and so forth. But I do think that it does serve a really important, it should serve, I think, as a really important warning for exactly what can happen if you don't, try to keep things, on the rails and above board and have people not simply respect the law, because the law at the end of the day really depends on people going along with those norms and embracing those norms. So I do think there's value there.
And also kind of going along with that, there's like this theme of fear throughout the movie, which I think kind of is resonating with an audience, can resonate with an audience today. So there was this great quote that said, "People shouldn't fear their governments. Governments should fear their people." And I was wondering how you all thought, like, the Wachowskis portrayed that idea throughout this movie. This idea that, like, fear is bigger if you, like, kind of let it consume you. So it's, like, this bigger idea and how you switch, how a society goes and switches from fearing their government to having the government fear them.
Oh, I think that... For one thing, that's my favorite line in the entire movie. And it's a line I think we all know that a large number of folks who claim to be libertarians have embraced. There is a reason why I have tentatively titled the book I'm working on "The Triumph of Fear." I mean, that was very deliberate, because when you look at the history of this country, and I was talking with my wife, this morning about a lot of this stuff, because she is quite frankly terrified with where things stand here on November the 4th, 2020. But I made the point that this streak of authoritarianism that I also think is very American has been with us since the founding. It was less than 10 years after the ratification and actually the Constitution coming into force, less than 10 years, that we had this new Federalist Party ram through the Alien and Sedition Acts in the Congress. You know, to this day, you know, easily the most, among the most, if not the most, anti-democratic, virtually totalitarian, you know, kind of legislative and political act that we've seen. You know, next to the institution of slavery itself, of course. So this idea that, you know, when people feel threatened, you know, to kind of borrow a biological term, they go hindbrain, and that's exactly what happened after 9/11, right? I mean, we had this situation where the attacks take place, and instead of doing, you know, the rational thing, which is to hold the investigations first to figure out why the attack succeeded, 6 weeks after the attacks, we ran through legislation, the Patriot Act, that is the supposed solution to why the attacks have occurred. And of course, there's not a single provision of the Patriot Act that I'm aware of that can be tied to actually stopping a subsequent attack on this country, or for that matter, American interest overseas. So bad things always happen, you know, when folks give in to fear. Unfortunately, you know, if I were a bookie, I have to admit, I'd almost always bet on fear, because that, unfortunately, is just too often how people react. And it helps to create the kind of climate that we have, the kind of feeling that we have. And when you create an entirely new government department, the Department of Homeland Security, which I prefer to refer to as the Department of Fatherland Security, which does nothing but hype threats day in and day out through press releases and all the rest of this kind of stuff. There's even a Twitter account, the U.S. Department of Fear, that does try to satirize this stuff as much as possible, but that's what we're living with. You know, that's the mentality that has been created and it's been sustained, and it has a warping effect. A dramatic warping effect. And you, at least I begin to believe that the more of these incidents that you have and the longer they go on, the more corrosive they are to attempts to try to preserve fundamental liberties.
You know, I say one interesting, and I realize I keep doing this sort of hipster thing. Well, you know, in the graphic novel, you know, forgive me. I'll do it again. One thing that is stressed much more is because they have the space of this long-running series, I think you would get a very different product if this had been, you know, a 10-episode HBO miniseries of the sort they did with Watchmen. But there's much more exploration there of the fact that those in power themselves actually also live in this sort of state of constant terror. And V's sort of elaborate knocking over all the dominoes plots in the comic involves sort of exploiting these internal kind of Game of Thrones machinations of the various senior government officials who are themselves at each other's throats. The idea that under a kind of totalitarian state, that everything is this kind of is effectively a state of nature, which is, you know, what Leviathan is supposed to rescue us from. But in fact, no, it is this savage, vicious sort of wilderness. Where, you know, there's this sort of mask of civility, but in fact, people are constantly at each other's throats and constantly nervous about their position. You see a little of that in a very much diluted way when you see Adam Sutler in a great bit of stunt casting played by John Hurt, famously portrayed Winston Smith in I think the best adaptation of 1984. But, you know, as this, who is seen always as this, you know, face on a screen, imposing like Big Brother and threatening people, in a kind of shout out to his prior role, or reversal of his prior role, and telling his subordinates, if you don't get results, it'll be you who's in, you know, up against the wall. And then the first time we actually see him in person, I think, and not as this giant screen face. He's this weak, terrified old man who's been kidnapped by one of his own subordinates and is unceremoniously shot in the head, sort of sobbing and pleading for his life. As you know, one of the, you know, essentially one of the inmates of this prison has beat the other to death. And that is, you know, one thing that stands out about the the whole torture sequence with Evie, the fake, the fake interrogation sequence, is again there. I think there's also an obvious, trans reading of that that's in the original, but this may be some of why the Wachowskis found it appealing, right? Is this kind of Gnostic idea of, you believe you are in a prison, but it's not. The guards are mannequins. The, the walls are, paper mache. The rat in the cell is a pet, basically. The prison you believe you're in is a construct, and in fact, you may be able to just walk out the doors anytime you please, as soon as you recognize that this prison is illusory. Obviously, sort of the literal prison in V's case, but in a sense, the prison of fear, the prison of believing in the structures of authority and the reality they've created. You've got the keys. This is Maya. This is the veil of illusion. And in fact, it has no power over you unless you consent to it.
And now for the part of the show where we get to share all of the other things that we've been enjoying during our time at home. This is Locked In. So, Pat and Julian, has anything else been something you've been really, really enjoying other than rewatching V for Vendetta?
The Mandalorian is here. Season 2 underway. Absolutely loved the opening episode. 54 minutes. Which makes me think that maybe Disney is giving them more money so they can actually stretch these things out to a full hour and give us even more more character development. But
one could hope.
Yeah, no, it's and so now, I'm just living for the Ahsoka Tano reveal. That's the number one reason that I'm so psyched about this season. For those of you who have only watched the Star Wars movies, if you have not watched the animated stuff, you really are missing out on an awful lot of stuff, but especially the final season of the Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. Star Wars Rebels is especially relevant for The Mandalorian. Anyway, that's my Star Wars homily. I'm channeling Aaron right now.
Yeah.
Beyond that, doing my best to try to read some of the rather large number of books that I've bought over the course of the last year or so, a lot of it in support of the research I'm doing for my own book, but some of this stuff just for my own edification. And one of them that I'm going through now is Tower of Skulls by Richard B. Frank, which is the first of a 3-volume series that he's doing on what he calls essentially the Asia-Pacific War. And so he looks at the whole conflict in the Pacific in the Second World War era, really starting with China and what happened there in China. And it's terrific. He's a fantastic historian. His book on Guadalcanal, for those of you who are interested in the Pacific War, his book on Guadalcanal, written in 1992, stands as easily the best on that campaign ever written. He's a great writer. So that's what I'm digging into.
Yeah, so actually, I think either Natalie, you or Landry mentioned Lovecraft Country, which I've belatedly been enjoying.
Oh, I still want to start that.
it's really amazing. It's very good. As well as, I don't remember if I've mentioned this on a previous episode, but The Boys, which is based on the Garth Ennis comic, sort of asks the question, what if there were superheroes, but they were like real people who had, often at a very young age, this kind of incredible, unaccountable power and fame and money, and what would they really behave like? And the answer is, of course, not very well. They might effectively, behave like supervillains, except to the extent that necessary to maintain a public front to keep the money coming in. So that's on the viewing front. I'm reading Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, who is probably best known as the author of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Piranesi is magical realist is probably not quite right, just not that realist. It's a sort of surrealist story about a man mostly alone in this sort of enormous hall structure full of various kinds of art and just what he does in this sort of strange, lonely environment, as well as Charlie Strauss's Dead Lies Dreaming. It's the most sort of recent installment of his very long-running series, The Laundry Files, so sort of the premise of which is effectively kind of Lovecraftian magic is real, and there are government agencies that are tasked with secretly dealing with this. It started as a kind of pastiche or spoof of British spy fiction, but it's kind of morphed into this different and much more interesting thing where I think in the present tense of the of that universe, spoilers, sorry, Nyarla Hotep from the Lovecraft mythos is essentially Prime Minister of Great Britain. So there's that. next up in my queue is the most recent Haruki Murakami, Killing Commendatore. And on the sort of work front, I just started Sarah Brain's Predict and Surveil, Data Discretion and the Future of Policing, which is looking nice. Quite interesting. And I'm looking forward to the release of Privacy at the Margins, which is a forthcoming, I think it's been a little bit delayed book that I'm really anticipating about privacy in marginalized communities. And I guess gaming-wise, I've been playing a bit of Among Us, which is a kind of fun social deduction trader game in the spirit of, you know, Mafia and Werewolf. And I've downloaded, I've not started it yet, but I'm looking forward to starting Watch Dogs Legion, the third game in the Watch Dogs series by Ubisoft, where it sort of centers on hackers in a, in this case, a kind of surveillance state London, and has this sort of interesting quirk of having sort of the city populated by people, all of whom can be kind of recruited and made playable with different sort of sets of skills to go around either social engineering or hacking things or, you know, using physical combat skills to navigate various missions. That looks maybe like the most sort of interesting installation in that series to date. I feel like Watch Dogs has been a series always with like a lot of potential and a lot of interest for folks like us, for like Pat and I, who work on surveillance issues, but this has never quite nailed it. And maybe this is the time they finally do that.
On my front, I'm reading The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. It's just like a fiction book. I'm really enjoying it. I'm like a little over halfway. It's basically this story of like a Hollywood socialite in the 1950s. But the book is set in like today. And it's her like recapping her whole life, and she's like never spoken in public about it. But it's very interesting. And then I also are keeping up with This Is Us. It came back on the TV. I just find that one of more enjoyable shows to kind of like put on in the background. And I've been following it since it started, and it just came back October 27th, I think. So that season is only two episodes in. And then I am almost done Schitt's Creek. I am in the fifth season. It has been worth every second. It's very lighthearted, and I feel like it got a lot of more attention since it won so many awards, but it's definitely a good way to distract myself from everything else going on. The character of David is absolutely hilarious. I sometimes want to channel my inner David, but anyway, so that's kind of what I've been up to. And, since I'm at home in Philly for the election time, I have been, spending a lot of time watching some children's movies as well, because I'm with my nephew. So lots of Disney Plus rewatch and rewatch, like Moana and A Bug's Life. So those have been fun to kind of see again.
I have been painting a lot of miniatures and avoiding election coverage, giving myself something to do with my hands, which has been nice. I also have just started playing Among Us, Julian, and he had messaged us about it, discussing some things with us about that game before. So I've been having a lot of fun actually getting to play it myself when I realized I could download it on mobile and just play via Discord. I have also been listening to a lot of Martha, which is a sort of punk rock band from, I believe, North England. Interesting sort of queer anarchist DIY pop punk band. It's very fun and catchy. I think people would really enjoy them. I just listened to a very, very interesting and well done, but tough to listen to podcast. It's called Crackdown, and it is produced by people who are living mostly with opioid and heroin addiction, actually created by them and not just telling their story for them. But specifically, there's an episode that I realized I was at a conference where they won an award at called Change Intolerance, where they basically tell the story of how in, I believe it was 2014, the government of British Columbia changed the methadone medication that they were using for their government-funded methadone program to something called Methadose. And it was basically a complete failure and didn't work more than a third of the time and induced all sorts of sickness. And is this really heartbreaking, interesting perspective about what can go wrong even with well-intentioned sort of drug treatment programs that people run. It's very, very interesting. I recommend people, if they're interested in that type of policy, check it out. I have also, and this is how I've been spending most of my nights with my wife, I have recently discovered the joy of the Netflix series Busted.
Oh, God.
It is incredible. Natalie, you're going to hate it as I describe it, but I guarantee you would enjoy it.
I can't wait.
It is a Korean variety show where all of these K-pop stars and K-drama celebrities and people that are famous in the sort of Korean media scene play fictional versions of themselves. So they go by their real name, but they play like... they play themselves if they were detectives. And there is this like, it's highly unscripted in certain portions, but there's also this mythology where they are detectives that are part of a team that are trying to solve a larger like conspiratorial case, but they have to do challenges in sort of this most extreme challenge / amazing race style thing where they're running around a city and they either have to do sort of slapstick comedy challenges or they have to solve logic puzzles and figure out words. I mean, any type of puzzle or game that you can think of that is sort of a way that they could test a detective for a fake show, they do. And it's also funny because you can tell they're trying to commit to the bit of the story that they're solving very serious crimes, but they're also, you know, being goofy, and they will run into other celebrities that have like cameo roles, and it'll be like, oh, I'm the friend of the murder victim, but it'll be another famous K-pop star, and they will not know who they have to walk in and like commit to the role when they're just going expecting to meet anyone. And so there's this like multiple levels that it operates on, but if you have no idea who these people are, like me, it's even more fun still, because you can tell we're supposed to be laughing at something or there's some sort of other meaning that you're not getting, and it's still fun. And there's a lot of banter between the stars, and you kind of learn about them and their personalities, and there's like the sort of goofy, like sort of dumber characters that some of them play, and it may not be a character, they might just be not as good at solving puzzles and mysteries. And then there's like the handsome leader, and it's just a very interesting show, unlike anything else, that makes me want to, you know, watch a lot more of these Korean variety shows, of which there are apparently a lot. Yeah, that's Busted on Netflix. If there is another significant date that you think that we need to remember other than the 5th of November, make sure to let us know on Twitter at Pop and Lock Pod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock with an E like the philosopher, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by me, Landry Ayers, as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.